This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Led Zeppelin was the most influential pioneer of heavy metal music. As the band's lead singer, my guest Robert Plant almost invented heavy metal singing and has influenced countless performers. Page also wrote one of the most popular and parodied hard rock ballads, Stairway to Heaven. Led Zeppelin formed in 1968 and broke up in 1980. Last year, 35th anniversary Zeppelin DVD and CD collections were released. Now Plant has a new CD that collects some of the recordings he made before and after Zeppelin, showing the mix of blues, pop, and rock that he's performed over the years. It's called 66 to Timbuktu. The first recording on it was made in 1966. The last track is from a 2003 concert in Timbuktu, a festival in which he performed along with African musicians. There's also a CD of that concert called Festival in the Desert. Robert Plant, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start from one of the rarities from your new CD, 66 to Timbuktu. And I want to start with something that you recorded before Led Zeppelin was created. And this is a You Better Run. This was a band, I think, that used to be called Texas Teens. And then when you joined it,
The Tennessee Teens, excuse me.
That's as far away from where you are as Texas.
Exactly that, yeah.
I don't know why,
I can't imagine why they chose a name like that, but they had, the group was in existence before I came on the scene. And they'd been playing residences in the clubs in Germany, rather like the Beatles were doing. Uh-huh. And I think everything American in those days in England was considered to be a sort of a good luck charm, you know, some kind of amulet. And so using a bit of Americana in the name was supposed to attract the people in the Midlands of England.
Was it partly an homage to Sun Records in Memphis?
No, not really. No, I don't think it was anything as bright as that or as coherent as that. In fact, really, there was no lean towards rockabilly with that group. It was more or less a very white Catholic Motown covers band.
And speaking of covers band, you do a cover here of a Young Rascals song, You Better mm-hmm. Run. It's just funny to think of you covering the Rascals.
Well, you know, the Rascals had a fantastic reputation amongst all musicians and still do. They're very, the quality of writing and the performance, fantastic vocals. And there was a great dynamism in their work. And, you know, when I first started singing that song, I was 16. And to try and get anywhere near the quality and the style of the Rascals in England at that time was virtually impossible. We just didn't have the Italian stuff in the blood, or maybe just the street corner stuff that they'd come out of. Music, the whole music culture in Britain was pretty weekend stuff for kids, you know.
What I find even more entertaining is that there's female backup singers on this and horns, which is just so different than what you became famous for with Led Zeppelin.
Yeah, I know. The day I actually walked into the studio in London, I had only been to London 3 or 4 times in my life at that point. I walked into the studio and I was absolutely blown away by the number of musicians. I think that the people who recorded me, who signed me to this recording, had got high hopes for me to become a new sort of parallel to Tom Jones. And so they threw everything in that they might have thrown in at that time just to make it work. And in different stages of my life, I've had a different overview or a different vision of those early recordings, especially track 2, which is even more out of character, I guess, with how people have come to know me. But in the very early days of a career, or whatever it was at the time, it was just amazing to be in the position at all, mm-hmm. you know, to get loose in front of a microphone. I mean, I was very young and very shy.
Well, let's shy. We'll get to that a little later. Okay.
I thought we might.
So this is Robert Plant from his new CD, 66 to Timbuktu, recorded in 1966, You'd Better Run. And by this time, the band is no longer called the Tennessee Teens. They are now Listen.
Yours. Now I'm closing all the doors. What you trying to do to my heart? keep trying to do to myself. Every time I see your face, see you in another place. What you trying to do to my soul, yeah.
You better run.
Robert Plant, recorded in 1966, featured on his new CD, 66 to Timbuktu. Your voice sounds really different on that than it sounded with Led Zeppelin. It's not as high. It's differently placed. It's different in nearly every way, I think.
Yeah, I think there was much more of a stated melody for that particular tune. The later work, or the work when I met up with Jimmy and we formed the band, the actual vocal presentation in Led Zeppelin was much more freeform, and there wasn't such a need in many cases to stick to a rigid melody, whereas the Rascals track was very punctuated and very staccato, both in the musicality and in the vocal work. I think really that these exercises were really important for me, because I'd always been wailing in the bands that I'd been in with very little concern about melody after the first verse. So yeah, you're right, it is obviously lower register because it has to follow the melody, and also the key of the song was predicted by the arranger, and I guess, you know, with there being horns on it and stuff, it was probably in B flat or F or something like that, which is a good key for horns. And I think you get a little bit of Led Zeppelin vocal at the very end. Always the fade outs to records, the very end, as the cartridges, the needle heads off into the great unknown. You always hear vocalists putting this great little bits and touches in. I used to be a huge fan of that. The vocalist finally gets the singer gets his way and is able to ad lib and scat on the outros, rather like Dion used to do it. And a lot of the blues guys, they'd start talking and vamping with their voice. So there's a bit of it. A little bit of it.
Okay,
I guess bit of that stuff that was to come.
I guess we should hear the very ending of it now, so let's give that a listen.
Keep on walking, keep on walking. Gotta get away from you. Cause I've got to leave you, girl.
That's Robert Plant before he was part of Led Zeppelin. We know with Led Zeppelin, you started singing a lot of like blues and rhythm and blues influence mm-hmm. material, like, you know, yeah. Muddy Waters, You Shook Me. Did you feel like you had to change your voice when you started singing music inspired, you know, by rhythm and blues?
Not really, because I'd always been, well, not always, but from the age of about 14 and a half, in the town where I lived, there was a very strong, healthy movement towards a kind of subculture, a bohemian culture where there were poetry meetings. There was a lot of post-bebop jazz being played and listened to. And the blues was, strangely enough, almost mainstream in this particular town, thanks to the art colleges and the students in the area. So I was very familiar with blues, with the idiom of singing. And I'd been singing like that for quite a long time, experimenting. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you listen to a lot of the early English and early American white kids who were involved with blues, Mike Bloomfield, Elvin Bishop, you know, I guess Dave Van Ronk, the people who worked in the coffee houses alongside Dylan in the early 60s, everybody, and Dylan as well, I mean, that first album, Down the Highway and See That My Grave Is Kept Clean. There's some great blues there. And everybody developed a style of their own, which was accommodating our natural, I suppose, restrictions and inabilities. So I was wailing all the time, and I'm sure that half the time it was not as good as it could have been. But, you know, it got better.
Now with Led Zeppelin, you were wailing over some pretty loud music.
Well, that's right. I had to wail. I had no choice, really. The equipment was pretty inferior in those days. And for PAs, the actual public address system at gigs was... I mean, I remember one night in Zeppelin, we played Columbus, Ohio, the university, with, I think, Jose Feliciano. And the PA was actually a cluster of speakers right up in the apex of the room. It was a circular building with the statutory 60s students sitting around, looking suitably astonished or vacant or whatever it was. And the PA was miles up in the air, and there was no chance on earth that the voice could project. Mm-hmm. So I did have to kick in a lot throughout those early days. I think it was not until about 1970 that Led Zeppelin actually purchased a PA, or rather, I purchased the PA because I was a singer. And then I made John Bonham pay some of it because he was the drummer. And we used two overhead microphones, a bass drum and a snare mic. So I said, well, you'd use four times more microphones than I do. As it happened, we reached an amicable solution as far as the cost of things.
How come you still have a voice after singing that loud for so long?
Oh, because it's all about dynamics. And it's also all about, with technique, the last thing in the world that you can do is just blast like crazy. You have to work your way into a tour as you work your way into an evening of singing. You have to take it steady to begin with, make sure that, if you can, that the introduction of the show is kind to you. That wasn't always the case in Led Zepp, but... I mean, I've been in dressing rooms with lots of musicians where the singers go into the toilet and start shrieking at the walls of the toilet, and it's very painful to the casual listener and onlooker, but they seem to think that psychologically is the answer, that it'll make them be much more warmed up when they go on stage. But I prefer Neil Young's way of doing it. You stand in a circle, and it's almost like sort of a kind of cosmic barbershop warm-up where you go, and you do that for about half an hour and have a lie down.
Right. So you actually warm up. Okay.
I don't warm up, but he does, and that's a good way of doing it.
Oh, so you admire it, but don't really do it yourself.
I haven't got time. I have a couple of hot cups of coffee, or a cup of tea, keep quiet, don't talk to anybody, sit in the dark for 5 minutes, and then go.
My guest is Robert Plant. His new CD, 66 to Timbuktu, collects recordings he made before and after Led Zeppelin. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Plant. From 1968 to 1980, he was the lead singer with Led Zeppelin. His new CD, 66 to Timbuktu, collects recordings he made before and after Zeppelin. Let's hear another track from your new CD, which is called 66 to Timbuktu. And we were talking about moving over toward blues and rhythm and blues music. Mm-hmm. And this is an early example of that. This is, again, before Led Zeppelin. From the late 60s. This is with Alexis Korner, the British blues musician. The song is called Operator. You already hear your voice sounding a little more Led Zeppelin-ish on this.
Exactly, yeah. And that was probably, I don't know, 6-7 months later than the first recording that you played. And really, it's just the idiom. It's just the style of music that dictates a different presentation.
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is like around 67, you'd say?
Yeah, early 67, I think.
Okay. So this is Robert Plant with Alexis Korner, Operator.
I've got to leave you, baby. I don't care what you say. Leave you, darling. Come back home one sunny day. Down the road. Down the road I go. What you gonna do? I'm gonna find myself a little woman. People to look after all my kids. Baby, I hate to leave you this way.
That's Robert Plant from his new CD, 66 to Timbuktu, which collects recordings that he made before and after playing with Led Zeppelin. Who were the first blues musicians, or rhythm and blues musicians, that you actually met?
I met Sonny Boy Williamson, the very famous Sonny Boy Williamson, who travelled through England in the early 60s. He travelled through Scandinavia and England with two German promoters, promoted a kind of blues train that visited quite big venues at the time. I would say they were pretty big, with a whole host of these romantic figures who drifted through my early teenage years. I was just dumbfounded at this beautiful, poignant music. And it was very seldom a band performance. It was more often than not one guy with a guitar, or maybe bass and drums behind, but you could absorb everything. It certainly wasn't the electric mayhem that came later.
As you know.
Yeah. But I mean, with Howlin' Wolf, Clapton and Steve Winwood and stuff like that. And, I mean, it must have been fantastic for the guys to play with the Wolf, because he was one of the most startling performers I ever saw. But nevertheless, it did get a bit too rock and roll. And within itself, the blues idiom at that time was still being performed by the same guys who personalized it in the first place. It was Sleepy John Estes, Bucker White, Son House. You know, there were some people who were main movers whose effect and cause and effect has brought me to this studio today.
So when you started recording, what was your idea of the kind of band you would eventually be in, the kind of singer you would become?
Well, when I started recording initially, going back to 66, I just wanted to create some kind of effect of black music, some kind of projection of black music. Well, I wouldn't say I wasn't. I would say that the contemporary black music of the time, the popular music that was coming over to Britain, was not blues, and it was a very accessible Motown sound. And some of the Chess recordings were pretty beautiful and accessible and stuff. But I was going for something else. I was trying to get into another area, which was much more dramatic. And at the same time as I was trying to project the blues, I was also incredibly aware of the effect of West Coast music. The San Francisco bands, the LA bands, were leaving a small mark on the British musicians. And to combine the two, to create a piece of music that sounded half Jefferson Airplane and half Howlin' Wolf, mm-hmm. was the kind of area that I was hoping to go in with the Band of Joy.
Well, one of the things Led Zeppelin did was create a really, like, white version of a music that was based in part on African-American blues.
That's right, yeah. And with varying degrees of success. I mean, I think that on Led Zeppelin 1, there was some fantastic... there was I Can't Quit You, Babe, which is written by Willie Dixon, originally performed by Otis Rush, was a great experiment. It allowed the band to perform and for the personality of the band to come through. And at the same time, it did justice to the original recordings.
Robert Plant has a new CD called 66 to Timbuktu, collecting recordings he made before and after Led Zeppelin. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Robert Plant. From 1968 to 1980, he was the lead singer of Led Zeppelin, one of the most influential bands in the history of hard rock and heavy metal. Now he has a new CD collecting recordings he made before and after Zeppelin. It's called 66 to Timbuktu. When we left off, we were talking about how blues musicians influenced the band. This is Led Zeppelin's recording Whole Lotta Love, which is based on a Willie Dixon song.
Yeah.
Led Zeppelin, my guest is singer Robert Plant. Anything you want to say about your singing on that track?
Well, I just, you know, as a very expressive time, I must say that I always would have liked to have thought that I could create a vocal syncopation and punctuation in as many different ways as possible. My voice is what it is. It's different now to how it was then. But it was punchy and it was joyous. And I guess, you know, my confidence was building by that time. I was 20 years old and I was really trying out all manner of different things. The effects of my childhood and my background, listening to Presley, listening to The Wolf, I tried to put them all into the songs that called for some kind of sexual innuendo or whatever it would be. It was partly blues, partly rock and roll, and it worked.
Now, Willie Dixon sued Led Zeppelin because it's based on his song You Need Love. He won the suit eventually. How did you feel about being sued by somebody who you admired so much, and especially like knowing that there's such a history of African-American artists getting ripped off and everything, to be perceived as a part of that? What was that like
for you? I take your point. That's a very succinct and a challenging question. We had an idea throughout the time in the band that we were in part of some kind of flow that began either with the chain gang music of Mississippi, Parchman Farm, Dockery's Plantation, down on with the medicine shows of the 19th century, Joe Turner, you know, C.C. Rider. The whole idea of the origin of these songs was quite translucent and almost eternal. And there were many times throughout all musicians' lives that you say, okay, this piece of music has come from here, and then it goes back to there, and it goes, and it dodges right back through to the very earliest time. This morning I was playing a Tommy McLennan CD on the way here in the car, and it's a CD I hadn't heard before. He was a guy who recorded for Victor in the 30s. And suddenly he starts singing Crosscut Saw, which was later made famous by Albert King on Stax. And it was identical, but it was 30 years earlier. And our impression was that all this music was kind of translucent and moved on down through time. And with the power of Jimmy Page's guitar riff and the actual Want a Whole Lot of Love vocal line, which became the chorus, and the psychedelic centerpiece, the melody was the lift, my responsibility, but it was only a part of the entire effect. So, you know, I just thought it was part of the game. I know that might sound naive and irresponsible, but there's so much of it about. Crossroads by Robert Johnson has got so many different writers depending upon which version you're looking at on the record label, that at the time the conjecture was, this is another one of those songs.
So are you saying that you didn't think it was actually written by Willie Dixon, that it was just a kind of conglomeration, or are you saying that it didn't?
No, our version was a conglomeration originality and the lift of the lyric.
Right, and you thought that kind of fit into what had always traditionally been done with music. So was it upsetting to you when Dixon sued?
Not at all. No. And it was, I think, some time after the band had disbanded. And, you know, there's so many... The same thing happened to us when Michael Jackson recorded a track. I think it was called Thriller. And never thought much about it. Just said, well, that sounds quite a lot like the riff in Heartbreaker, the Led Zeppelin riff. And people now employ musicologists to check out the various... proximities to melody and the various refrains, and then they come up with a solution or a plot as to whether or not one would be successful if you went to court. It's a sign of the times.
Right. Well, you know, earlier you were saying that when you started recording, you were shy. And by the time you're in Led Zeppelin, you're singing about, you know, giving her every inch of your love. And so, you know, something had to happen to that shyness on stage. Can you talk about the transformation from, you know, the shy Robert Plant to the much more...
go
ahead.
The lyric just developed in the studio, which was a free-form ad-lib. We were talking earlier on about the ends of songs, mm-hmm. about the free-form aspects of it.
Yeah.
There is so much innuendo in the blues, and a lot of English musicians were very fired by Robert Johnson, who to whom we all owe more or less our very existence, I guess. And the innuendo, whether it would be Terraplane Blues, where he was singing about the parallels between his woman and an automobile, or Traveling Riverside Blues, when he's mentioning the famous Squeeze My Lemon line.
Yes, which you made far more famous, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it's all there. It's public domain.
Right, right.
The Lemon Song. It's all about the sort of barrel house, bawdy, juke joint aspects of Saturday night music. So I think I was probably still shy, but I was playing in to character, if you like, with these songs, because it was such, Whole Lot of Love was such a kind of funky, sexy piece of music at the time. It had a fantastic lope to it. And taking the original Willie Dixon lyric, you know, you need cooling, I ain't fooling. I mean, that whole idea, it's not talking about cookery lessons or gardening tips. So the whole thing was based on some kind of sexual innuendo, which I think at the age of 20 was okay.
Can you talk a little bit about creating the visual image to go along with this new Robert Plant that was singing these songs that were laced with sexual innuendo?
No, I don't know how many of those songs particularly were aimed in that sort of free-form fashion, but the image has got very little to do with the lyric. It had just got to do with the times, and at that time, Janis Joplin had a particular way of looking. And the whole Renaissance clothing, the whole idea of the beautiful clothes and the stuff, that the entire wardrobe of movie stars deceased ended up on Sunset Boulevard. There were some beautiful clothes to buy, and they just seemed to be absolutely appropriate. We were all very, very skinny kids.
Uh-huh.
You know, 160 pounds and not a lot of muscle, just a lot of energy. So there was a look, and that look was kind of universal, really. It didn't have anything to do with the lyrics. I mean, we could just as easily have been a kind of folk band or, right. You know, another Crosby, Stills and Nash, perhaps, and we still would have been dressing the same way.
My guest is Robert Plant. His new CD, 66 to Timbuktu, collects recordings he made before and after Led Zeppelin. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Plant. From 1968 to 1980, he was the lead singer with Led Zeppelin. His new CD, 66 to Timbuktu, collects recordings he made before and after Zeppelin. Listen, I want to play something for you. I know you must be asked everywhere you go about the lyrics to Stairway to Heaven and what they mean and so on and so on. Did you ever hear the Tiny Tim version of it? I know,
yeah.
Everybody has their most like bizarre version they want to play for you, but do you know the Tiny Tim version?
I have a copy. In fact, I just chucked it away the other day when I was going through some stuff. I think my favorite version is Little Roger and the Goosebumps.
Oh, who were they?
Well, it was a record that was built around the theme for Gilligan's Isle, the TV program. And our lawyer at the time in New York was absolutely furious that anybody should touch this song, this pinnacle of endeavor and artistic creativity with... You know, and I thought it was that and Hairway to Stephen which was by Deck Chairs Overboard, I think, an Australian punk band. It's pretty good. There is also, while we're making sure that we keep the right temperature of reverence here for that piece of music, there was a TV show in Australia called The Money or the Gun, and every artist that went on there had to do a version of Stairway to Heaven. So I've got 21, a video of 21 people. There's a fat Elvis doing it like Viva Las Vegas. There's a girls' choir who I could have given every inch of my love to if the times had been right. There's, an Italian guy cooking pizza. And the song deserved it.
What do you mean by that, as its author?
Well, I mean, because of the pinnacle of and the beauty of the song, sooner or later that has to turn around and swing the other way, like My Way or God Save the Queen, you know. It gets, after a while, it's a great target for pointing a finger of, a skeptical finger in the hoots of derision, and that's what happens. I think Tiny Tim was perhaps one of the more respectful versions.
Oh, it's a great, it's like the lounge version.
Absolutely, yeah.
The swing and lounge version. I'm just going to play a little bit of it for our listeners.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, here it is. It's Tiny Tim with a Brave Combo.
There's a lady who's sure all that glitters is gold, and she's buying a stairway to heaven. And when she gets there, she knows if the stars are closed, with a word she can get what she came for.
Whoa, whoa, and she's buying a stairway to heaven.
So, you know, I'll confess to you that it wasn't until I heard Tiny Tim singing the song that I understood exactly what the lyrics were. And, you know, one of the lines is, if there's a bustle in your hedgerow, don't be alarmed now. It's just a sprig leaf from the May Queen.
A spring clean.
A spring clean.
But a spring clean.
Oh, a spring clean as in spring cleaning.
Yeah.
Oh. It's such a proper sounding line.
Well, sprig leaf sounds very suggestive. I can't imagine.
Well, but Mayclean and hedgerow and bustle and alarmed. It's so.
It's onomatopoeic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What was going through your mind when you wrote this?
I was thinking about the need for a sort of more organic relationship between our generation at the time, who were living faster than fast, and our environment, and the our times were very I suppose harum scarum, and Stairway to Heaven developed as a piece of music that one evening with Jimmy and myself, and that kind of tone, that idiom about returning to nature to look for all the signs, to be aware of our environment yet again by the way that the old people, the people from long ago, marshalled their days and marched to a different beat altogether. I thought it was an appropriate idiom to move into because of the sort of majesty of the chord movement.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Plant, and he has a new CD that includes recordings he made before and after Led Zeppelin. Let's hear another after Led Zeppelin recording from your new CD 62 to Timbuktu. Mm-hmm. And this is Philadelphia Baby. This is a Charlie Rich song, a Charlie Rich the country singer. And tell us why you recorded this. This is also, you know, not very Led Zeppelin sounding.
Well, I disagree entirely.
Do you? Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, it's more Led Zeppelin than a lot of actual Led Zeppelin tunes, because Jimmy and I were very, very big fans of the whole Memphis, Tennessee scene. When we were talking at the top of the program about Tennessee, Charlie Rich was one of the founder and more successful early artists on the whole Sun Records, Phillips International and Judd Records combination, which was all coming out of Memphis. And in Zeppelin, we'd often lent, especially at sound checks and in jams in the middle of various songs, we'd go straight to rockabilly. And Charlie Rich was one of the greater a more stylish, more, I guess, developed singers. As time went on, he became a country singer, but in the beginning he was a rocker, and that was one of his better songs.
Well, let's hear it. This is you with Dave Edmunds on guitar, Phil Collins on drums, and recorded in, do you remember the year?
About 83, I should think.
Okay, let's hear it. This is Philadelphia Baby. Robert Plant from his new CD, 66 to Timbuktu, which features recordings he made before and after Led Zeppelin. That's one of the after recordings. Has it been hard for you, was it hard initially anyways, to find, to keep your audience interested, how do I put this, you become famous for doing one thing and then it's time to move on and sometimes audiences won't let you.
That's correct.
So it wasn't hard to move on because you were so popular.
Yeah, but it wasn't hard to move on because from our angle and our point of view, looking at it subjectively, I hadn't played in America for a long time, since 1977. And the band disbanded in 1980. And without John, there was no real... For me, there was the heart of the group had gone, and the sort of motive behind carrying on would have been a lot different with a new member and different personnel. It would be, you know, it just wouldn't be what it had been. The power of invention, the fun, the chaos, the drama, the kind of chemical interaction between the four guys was, I think, I mean, it was obviously responsible for some fantastic music. It was responsible for some beautiful music, and it would be ridiculous to try and replace it. So to stand on my own, finally, under those circumstances, was very arresting, and I felt very moved, and I realized that I'd lost a really important part of my life when John moved on and passed away. And
right.
I knew that whatever I had to do it by my own volition and do it on my own. And it didn't matter one way or another what happened, just so long as I understood what my priorities were from that time onwards, and I had to go it alone.
My guest is Robert Plant. His new CD, 66 to Timbuktu, collects recordings he made before and after Led Zeppelin. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Plant. From 1968 to 1980, he was the lead singer with Led Zeppelin. His new CD, 66 to Timbuktu, collects recordings he made before and after Zeppelin. Led Zeppelin was one of the bands that kind of created heavy metal. Whether you consider their music heavy metal or not, it certainly led the way for heavy metal. Are there things that you would like to and not like to take credit for in the bands that came after and were inspired in part by Zeppelin?
Well, you know, sort of the inspiration or the lift, if you like, was multifaceted in many respects. So many drummers emulated John, and so many guitarists emulated Jimmy. And I'm sure that John Paul Jones's bass player, being what it was, was studied by bass players everywhere. So on a musical level, it was very flattering, I'm sure, for all the guys to see and to hear the way that people had taken their style and taken it into their own capability one way or another. And you did see a lot of guitarists leaning back. The whole style of presentation was lifted, and that's fine. You know, that's absolutely fine. It's a great compliment, if you like. Also, it is quite simplistic. It's just full force rock and roll with some imaginative writing and some great displays of creativity and power. But the actual taking the music and the songs and then moving them around a little bit, you know, people take a little thread of this, that and the other. We were talking about A Whole Lot of Love for mm-hmm. their own mm-hmm. benefit all through time. All through time, whether it's Pearl Jam, the Beastie Boys, Mother Love Bone, you know, it's going on everywhere. Now, I don't know too much about any of that, and I don't have an opinion one way or another, because I think that the popular music in as a mainstay of sort of pop culture is rather like a kind of thieving magpie. It kind of swoops down and takes a little bit of this and a pinch of that and a touch of this and a touch of that. And, you know, the nuances of Led Zepp that they couldn't touch were the beautiful parts that that were just unattainable, I guess.
What do you think of when you see other bands, like from the heavy metal era, who at their age are still doing the big heavy metal thing and doing it in full regalia? I'm thinking of like Kiss or Aerosmith.
Well, is it a means to an end? I mean, it's satisfying some need, not with the audience, because really when you get to our time as entertainers, as performers, you can afford to be quite selfish as to how you want to go about things. I mean, in truth, the idea of when success arrives, it's such a kind of peculiar phenomena to realize that what you're doing is actually being accepted by a huge amorphous mass of mankind, that it must be, and I'm sure that it was, if I can't remember today, it must have been quite addictive. This kind of worship and respect, and that's, and I think if people want to maintain that as some kind of pattern of life in their 50s, then that's their choice. But there's so many other ways to sing and to perform and to project and to learn. And my time in Timbuktu with those musicians was a learning process and a learning curve, which has made me a better singer. I think that rather than just keep on repeating and revisiting old, well-tried and tested pathways, there are two paths you can go by.
Yes, there are two paths you can go by, but in the long run, there's still time to change the road you're on.
That's Led Zeppelin and Stairway to Heaven.